Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And that debt is fraud. And it is now or never. And what is it going to take? As a matter of fact, I think I forgot last time or a couple times the importance of constitutional compliance and supporting Jerry Winstrand, who is out in Missouri running a statewide campaign. He needs as much help and support as he can possibly get, folks. And so we're hoping that we can get some support out of this audience. Whatever you can share, I'm doing everything I can to support Jerry, as well as all these people who are out actually becoming champions for the Constitution. If they're running a campaign, I'll be adding their names to the list. But at this point in time, for the 2026 election, it is Jerry Winstrand that is actually running a statewide race. So anyway, with that, let's dive into the Virginia ratification debate. So this is where we start. And so welcome back, Sean. Any go backs? Any go back?
No, I don't have any go backs. Okay. I don't see any highlights in here.
Ah, but there are highlights. So
there we go.
A lack of consistency. Sometimes the highlights are all the way pegged to the left, and in this one they're indented. So you find the first one is jurisdiction. But before we get to that. As you open this up, folks, and as you read through this, you will see no heated debate whatsoever of how the delegates that went to the convention in Philadelphia violated their commission. Not a word. You will find, and we will see here, and I'm going to highlight it, that they bring it up again. The anti-federalists bring it up again. Hey, you know, these guys violated their commission. And or they keep on going back to, you know, saying the same arguments over and go, hey, you know, we already refuted these things. Why do you keep bringing them up? But the point is that they didn't capture, just like, so I know for a fact that this was one of the conventions that required and forced a vote. No record of it, at least not in these debates. I don't have a copy of it. And I don't know how, I think it's Paula Meyer, or the one that wrote The Struggle for the Ratification of the Constitution. A great book, folks. I recommend you read it. it's very unbiased. She just kind of talks about, you know, the Federalists, the Anti-Federalists, and so forth. But to me, when you're looking at this, as they kick this off, they spend 2 days talking about the rules. And I bring this up because, you know, in some of the debates, they kind of show that stuff, the administrative stuff, some of them don't. With this one, they do. And as they start going through the debates, it's very quickly pointed out, we're not even following the rules we set, because they were supposed to go through it chronologically. And next thing you know, I think it's Patrick Henry or somebody that actually starts jumping down into Article 1, Section 8 or something like that, and starts complaining about something. Hold on here, we haven't even covered these other things yet. So this is June, and let me put some other context to this. At this point in time, the Constitution has been ratified by 8 states. As they're meeting on June 2nd, kicking this off, New Hampshire hasn't met yet. New Hampshire hasn't been the 9th pillar in ratifying. So at this point in time, Virginia could be that 9th pillar. Now, everybody knew going in that New Hampshire met and debated earlier on in, I think, January, February timeframe, and they chose not to do anything. They chose to convene and then reconvene later, much like what North Carolina ended up doing. And as soon as the Constitution had been ratified and moved forward, I think that helped justify North Carolina to say, you know what, now that we see that this government's going to move forward, let's just sit back, You know, let's sit on the porch. Let's grab, you know, some bacon and chew the fat. And let's, you know, discuss what we see and commentary and what have you out of this new government. And within the following year of 1789, I think it was by November, was when North Carolina ended up November 21st, 1789, they ratified the Constitution. So it was only 6 months later, from May to November. That's about 6 months. So, interestingly enough, as we read through the debates, they start off with the positioning. Now, one position that you have to be aware of is Governor Randolph. Governor Randolph was one that refused to sign the Constitution. And so he ends up showing up as a Federalist in supporting the Constitution after he regrets not signing it. I think emotions got the best of him, and I honestly think that George Mason was probably that big motivator, because if Mason, he was a drama queen. I mean, he was the one that created the drama over the, and rightfully so, over slavery. When he said every slave owner is a petty tyrant, that God can't punish nations and states in heaven, so he'll punish this nation and these states for maintaining slavery. That was on August 22nd. We covered that in the convention as well. I highlighted that. And then he really goes into drama queen mode at the very end, because there wasn't a Bill of Rights. He wanted to actually chair and have a committee of drawing up a Bill of Rights, but that didn't happen. And why? Because he did the Bill of Rights for Virginia, and everybody loved them. It seemed like all the other states were applauding and kind of following and kind of copying what they did. And so, proud of his work. I can't fault a man for that. But he went into this, I'll just say, this drama queen mode, or Karen. He said, I'd rather cut off my right arm than sign that document. And I'm going, wow. As I look at it today, without the Bill of Rights, this is an awesome Constitution. The way it was described, and if they would have followed it, they didn't need a Bill of Rights. And as we were just talking yesterday, how Dollard basically stood up and said, because it has no Bill of Rights, this is going to be an aristocracy and ultimately become a monarchy. And so we can see how we've gone away from, and it is, you can see an aristocracy in America. You can actually see the classes and the affluent basically owning, you know, the federal government positions as well as state positions and so forth. But that's not because they're following the Constitution and abiding by that. No, that's because they created the party system, and now the party has control, and now the party gets to control, you know, who rises to power and so forth. As we, you know, as we're looking at the Virginia ratification debates, I'm just trying to set the stage of the key players. On the Federalist side, Governor Randolph has some splaining to do, if you're familiar with I Love Lucy. And George Mason really leads the charge against the Constitution in so many different ways. And interestingly enough, we will actually get him, and I've highlighted these, to where he actually agrees, well, yeah, you're right, but, you know, it doesn't mean that men can't do bad things. And, you know, and how many times have we said that, of course, laws get violated, people break the rules, you know, power, you know, they're going to try to assume more power. That doesn't mean that we're granting them that power to assume more power. That means that they're going to be violating it to do that. We have to hold them in check. I mean, it became like a broken record, if you know what I mean. Right? You understand, Sean?
Absolutely.
So it's kind of like stating the obvious. And all of the delegates there, you know, at least enough of them were honest enough. And one of the things I've never done is I've never really gone through the voting and all of that like I did with Massachusetts. But I would not be surprised to find out that the Constitution was ratified more by counties than it was by population. In other words, percentage-wise. And I say that because you may have had iron, or I'll call them lightning rods, in counties where you had one leader that was a Federalist and one leader that was an anti-Federalist, and then you had, you know, the second class and third class of people, you know, representing the different counties that were behind that. And I'll give you a good example. One county that we know for a fact was the county that had James Monroe and James Madison. Both of them were lightning rods for the different sides. I believe Madison and that county, if I go and probably count, I believe Madison carried the county as that lightning rod that influenced them more than James Monroe. And so I would think that, just like when we saw in Massachusetts, I think it was like, if I remember correctly, it was 62% by demographics and 80-some percent by county. That's what you'll see. And when you look at it and you think about, you know, the importance of maintaining boundaries for amendments, i.e. the Article 5 process of requiring three-fourths of the states to ratify something, we are far better served, because I think common sense, logic, and reason will prevail when it is posed to the majority of the people of each of the counties instead of by population, because we can easily get into population centers that go just ideologically over the, you know, over the edge. They're just, you know, they're foaming at the mouth, like we see in Seattle and so forth. They're just, there's no common sense, logic, and reason. But in the other counties, there seems to be at least enough discord, but debate and dialogue to allow that common sense, logic, and reason to operate and maintain, you know, this, I'll just say, this proper balance of government. This is why we see throughout every state in the union, except for maybe one or two, and I think Rhode Island might be one of those states that is all blue, because it's just one big city. One big urban area. When we look at most states that actually have rural and, you know, suburbs and so forth, you're going to find that the majority of the state is red, because the population center and those ideologues, you know, aren't out there really struggling and working. Those are, you know, the salt of the earth type of people that are working. The people that are in the cities, that's where, you know, you get into the old projects, and you got people living on welfare, and they just want to, you know, I want to increase my welfare. So the only way to do that is to get government to give me more services, give me more benefits, and so forth. And so that doesn't happen out in the country, where you got to pay rent and so forth. There's no projects out in the country. At least there weren't. They're starting to put them out there, if you didn't know that. But that's the topic for another day. Anyway, so this is kind of setting the stage for going into the Virginia debates, which is going to take a while. Anything, Sean, before we kick off?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that on your point about the population centers versus the rural areas, I think another thing that adds into that is just the ideology of self-reliance. Because the people who live in the cities are actually unsustainable on their own. They have to be supplied. They have to have food brought in. Everything that they need has to come from somewhere else.
Right.
They don't make anything. They don't build anything. So I think that has a lot to do with the mentality of, and the ideology of the people who inhabit these different areas.
Sure.
But
sure.
The rural people are used to providing for themselves in a community, where in population centers, it's a more of, oh, well, I can believe anything that I want, and, you know, I need to be provided for and have my freedom to believe these things.
Yeah.
Where in the country, you know, you can believe what you want, but it's not going to put hay in the barn.
Yeah, and it's not going to put eggs in your basket either. So
exactly.
So, interestingly enough, you know, because I think about how you have to be able to provide a viable service as a city to be able to survive and thrive as a city. And internationally, there is one city that stands alone in thriving, and that's Singapore. Because Singapore is the nation, Singapore, the city and nation. In other words, there's no rural to Singapore. Now, they're expanding Singapore by reclaiming more and more water, or I should say they're, you know, dredging and dredging to create more land for Singapore to grow as its population continues to grow. But Singapore has to be a very viable body of government and people to be able to do transactions, to obtain food, you know, currency species, those types of things for what they do. And so from banking and whatever Singapore, because they're not even in manufacturing. I don't know of a plant in Singapore that really produces worldwide products or anything like Taiwan and so forth. So anyway, yeah, you're absolutely right. We live in a day where symbiosis is what allows those cities to thrive. But when the cancer of collectivism and communism takes over and not allows, you know, the individuals and individual entrepreneurial individualism, those types of things, to thrive in the city, and it's all about collectivism like Seattle versus Singapore, then you can see how that is a cancer that is absolutely destructive. We see Seattle right now falling into the abyss. And there's many other cities that are in that exact same. I mean, New York is going down the same path because they've elected a radical, you know, communist as well as a communist Islamist. Anyway, I digress. Anything else to add?
No, sir.
Okay. There's a lot to be said about symbiosis. I mean, when you get to a point of production of one thing, you get to a point where you can't actually fix your own cars and you know, make your own furniture and go and cut down your own wood to heat your home. You literally get to this point where at least you're making enough money to do transactions to provide for yourself in all those other arenas. And you depend on others to heat your home, to make your bread, those types of things. And Franklin Covey talked about that, how we've matured as a point, as a society, where if you do, you know, if you start playing with these different sectors, these different markets and so forth, it could create a calamity. And that's exactly what communism does, is it plays with these sectors to say, hey, you shouldn't have so much. Anyway, so, all right, let's start off with Mr. Nicholas and his little oration on jurisdiction. Go ahead.
It is objected, however, as a defect in the Constitution that it does not prohibit the House of Representatives from giving their powers, particularly that respecting the support, etc., of armies out of their hands for a longer term than 2 years. Here, I think the enemies to the plan reason unfairly. They first suppose that Congress, from a love of power natural to all, will, in general, abuse that with which they are invested. And then they would make us apprehend that the House of Representatives, notwithstanding their love of power, and it must be supposed as great in a branch of Congress as in the whole, will give out of their hands the only check which can ensure to them the continuance of participation of the powers lodged in Congress in general. In England, there is no restraint of this kind on the Parliament, and yet there is no instance of a money bill being passed for a longer term than 1 year. The proposed plan, therefore, when it declares that no appropriation for the support of an army shall be made for a longer term than 2 years, introduces a check unknown to the English Constitution, and one which will be found very powerful when we reflect that if the House of Representatives could be prevailed on to make an appropriation for an army for 2 years, at the end of that time there will be a new choice of representatives. Thus, I insist that security does not depend on the number of representatives. The experience of that country also shows that many of their counties and cities contain a greater number of souls than will be entitled to a representation in America. And yet the representatives chosen in those places have been the most strenuous advocates of liberty and have exerted themselves in the defense of it, even in opposition to those chosen by much smaller numbers. Many of the senatorial districts in Virginia also contain a greater number of souls, and yet I suppose no gentleman within these walls will pay the senators chosen by them so poor a compliment as to attribute less wisdom and virtue to them than to the delegates chosen from single counties. And as there is greater probability that the electors in a large district will be more independent, so I think the representatives chosen in such districts will be more so too. For those who have sold themselves to their representatives will have no right to complain if they, in their turn, barter away their rights and liberties. But those who have not themselves been bought will never consent to be sold. Another objection made to the small number of representatives is that admitting they were sufficient to secure their integrity, yet they cannot be acquainted with the local situation and circumstances of their constituents. When we attend to the object of their jurisdiction, we find this objection insupportable. Congress will superintend the great national interests of the Union. Local concerns are left to the state legislatures. When the members compare and communicate to one another their knowledge of their respective districts and states, their collective intelligence will sufficiently enable them to perform the objects of their cognizance. They cannot extend their influence or agency to any objects but those of a general nature. The representatives will, therefore, be sufficiently acquainted with the interests of their states, although chosen by large districts, as long as the people remain virtuous and uncorrupted, so long, we may fairly conclude, will their representatives, even at their present number, guard their interests and discharge their duty with fidelity and zeal. When they become otherwise, no government can possibly secure their freedom.
Okay, so a nice oration that talks about the difference between the parliament and how parliament on its own, you know, kind of keeps it to 1 year, but there's no law in a constitution in England that mandates that. And yet in the U.S. Constitution, they're given 2 years, but there's nothing that kept parliament from, again, and to the day, I don't think that they're still following that. Things really went sideways in England. I mean, look at England today. But here's the thing. When we look at what ended up happening, did Congress properly create a standing army when they started deploying people to go into the Western Expanse to maintain security for not only the territories, but new states joining the Union? No. What they ended up doing, and Mason will cover this later, is what they ended up doing was they ended up assuming this need and justification. Well, we need to take over these Western territories. We need this. This is in our interest. And they ignored the Constitution, as well as they ignored the necessity of states supporting and sustaining themselves. And I know I've covered this quite a bit. But the point is that, you know, it wasn't the Dick Act that was the beginning of the crumbling of this entire, you know, apparatus of the militia, you know, army and all of that. It literally started with the justification of maintaining the cavalry and the army and this apparatus moving westward so that we could occupy this, and they ultimately ended up creating a standing army across the United States, across the entire territory, as well as the new states in the Union. I mean, most of the old states in the Union didn't have military troops, you know, feeding themselves and riding around and so forth. It was very common in all the new states and in the West. So, anyway, We're going into break. We will be right back after the short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so anything to go back? Or, I mean, there's the little highlight in green that really kind of gets to the point that when you're really looking at the jurisdiction, Congress needs to really, you know, attend to this and maintain this. Because, you know, if not, then the concern goes to the state legislatures to say, hey, look, you can't be doing this. Because they get the army from the states. So anyway, are you ready to move forward, or you got another point or anything else?
We are ready, sir.
Okay. So the next day, June 5th, Mr. Pendleton brings up a point or a note. So let's go through this little point right here. Go ahead.
All right, sir. I'm trying to find it. It's quite far down where I was.
It's probably about six. It's on page. Let me get it to you. Page 23. It's called Note.
Note.
Yes.
Yes, sir. But it is represented to be a consolidated government, annihilating that of the states, a consolidated government with so extensive a territory as the United States cannot admit of without terminating in despotism. If this be such a government, I will confess with my worthy friend that it is inadmissible over such a territory as this country. Let us consider whether it be such a government or not. I should understand a consolidated government to be that which should have the sole and exclusive power, legislative, executive, and judicial without any limitation. Is this such a government, or can it be changed to such a one? It only extends to the general purposes of the Union. It does not intermeddle with the local, particular affairs of the states. Can Congress legislate for the state of Virginia? Can they make a law altering the form of transferring property or the rule of descents in Virginia? In one word, can they make a single law for the individual exclusive purpose of any one state? It is the interest of the federal to preserve the state governments. Upon the latter, the existence of the former depends. The Senate derives its existence immediately from the state legislatures, and the representatives and president are elected under their direction and control. They also preserve order among the citizens of their respective states, and without order and peace, no society can possibly exist. Unless, therefore, there be state legislatures to continue the existence of Congress and preserve order and peace among the inhabitants, this general government, with which gentlemen suppose will annihilate the state's governments, must itself be destroyed. When, therefore, the federal government is, in so many respects, so absolutely dependent on the state governments, I wonder how any gentleman reflecting on the subject could have conceived an idea of a possibility of the former destroying the latter. But the power of laying direct taxes is objected to. Government must be supported. This cannot be done without a revenue. If a sufficient revenue be not otherwise raised, recurrence must be had to direct taxation. gentlemen admit this, but insist on the propriety of first applying to the state legislatures. Let us consider the consequence that would result from this. In the first place, time would be lost by it. Congress would make requisitions in December. Our legislature do not meet till October. Here would be a considerable loss of time, admitting the requisitions to be fully complied with. But suppose the requisitions to be refused, would it not be dangerous to send a collector to collect the congressional taxes after the state legislature had absolutely refused to comply with the demands of Congress? Would not resistance to collectors be the probable consequence? Would not this resistance terminate in confusion and a dissolution of the Union? The concurrent power of two different bodies laying direct taxes is objected to. These taxes are for two different purposes and cannot interfere with one another. I can see no danger resulting from this, and we must suppose that a very small sum, more than the impost, would be sufficient. But the representation is supposed too small. I confess, I think with the gentleman who opened the debate, Mr. Nicholas, on this subject, I think he gave a very satisfactory answer to this objection, when he observed that, though the number might be insufficient to convey information of necessary local interest to a state legislature, yet it was sufficient for the federal legislature, who are to act only on general subjects, in which this state is concerned in common with other states. The apportionment of representation and taxation by the same scale is just. It removes the objection that while Virginia paid 1/6 part of the expenses of the Union, she had no more weight in public councils than Delaware, which paid but a very small portion. By this just apportionment, she is put on a footing with the small states in point of representation and influence in councils. I cannot imagine a more judicious principle than is here fixed by the Constitution. The number shall not exceed 1 for every 30,000. But it is objected that the number may be less. If Virginia sins in that proportion, I ask, where is the power in Congress to reject them? States might incline to send too many. They are therefore restrained. But can it be doubted that they will send the number they are entitled to? We may be therefore sure from this principle unequivocally fixed in the Constitution that the number of our representatives will be in proportion to the increase or decrease of our population. I can truly say that I am of no party, nor actuated by any influence, but the true interest and real happiness of those whom I represent and my age and situation, I trust, will sufficiently demonstrate the truth of this assertion. I cannot conclude without adding that I am perfectly satisfied with this part of the system.
So, kind of a long oration, but one of the things he points out is Mr. Nicholas really did a good job in clarifying this. And we'd already read one thing from Mr. Nicholas. Now, Mr. Nicholas, to me, is like a James Madison of Kentucky. Nicholas was a representative out of the Kentucky, or out of the territory of Kentucky, out of a county in that territory. And so that's why he was at the debates, because at this point in time, Kentucky was still a part of Virginia. But you're going to find that Mr. Nicholas is very good at being very succinct and being, you know, help clarifying issues or misunderstandings and so forth. And I like citing him in many of the works that we use for the petitions and so forth, because he's just like Madison. And I mean, everybody cites Madison, but there's people like Nicholas, Iredell, and others through the different states that do a really good job of helping, you know, clarify or, you know, elucidate or define, you know, what the heck that clause means or what the heck the government's to do and so forth. So anyway, now I actually dive into some anti-federalist points. And so Mr. Henry, this is the Mr. Patrick Henry, that's going to make a couple of different comments regarding the militia. And so there's the first one here, which is a short one. Let's go ahead.
My great objection to this government is that it does not leave us the means of defending our rights or of waging war against tyrants. It is urged by some gentlemen that this new plan will bring us an acquisition of strength, an army, and the militia of the states. This is an idea extremely ridiculous. Gentlemen cannot be earnest. This acquisition will trample on our fallen liberty. Let my beloved Americans guard against that fatal lethargy that has pervaded the universe. Have we the means of resisting disciplined armies when our only defense, the militia, is put into the hands of Congress?
Okay, so just keep that in mind, what he said there. Now let's read the next one. Go ahead. And this is where he, yes, just
the clause before you gives a power.
No. Actually, taxes. So it's up from that. It's on, this one is on page 29 at the very, very bottom. It says 24 militia. There should have been two of those. And it says, let me here call your attention. Oh, no. I'm sorry. There's right. That yellow part. That yeah, you got it. You're right. Okay.
But I got you. Let me here call your attention to that part which gives the Congress power, quote, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers, and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress, end quote. By this, sir, you see that their control over our last and best defense is unlimited. If they neglect or refuse to discipline or arm our militia, they will be useless. The states can do neither, this power being exclusively given to Congress.
So Mr. Henry takes these points, objects to them, and then basically provides this assertion, but fails to really provide exactly how can, you know, what he's asserting, how can that happen? And ultimately it comes down to this, that if the federal government actually takes full control over, then they would be violating the state's responsibility, that the states are the ones that are supposed to be training. It is the states that are supposed to be appointing the officers. They wanted to make sure. And so this is something interesting. The states are the ones to make sure that the federal government doesn't create a gang of sycophants. So that if each of the states actually elevate their own, then they're forcing, you know, these people who may not have ever gotten along because of just personality problems. I don't like the way that guy, you know, that I don't like that Southerner, the way he talks or the way he acts. I've never made him a general. And it would have eliminated the ability of having what I would call equal representation within the army. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so,
just tactically, it doesn't make any sense.
I get that. But the whole point is to create these checks and balances so that the federal government would have its hands tied, so that they would have to create a system that would basically build itself or be fully dependent upon neutrality, so that it couldn't favor. So one of the things that actually comes out as we look towards the Civil War, what states actually had a whole lot of officers and a whole lot of people in the active army because of the cavalry and everything else? What states was it that was providing people joining the cavalry and the standing army that they ended up creating? Do you know?
Virginia.
Well, it was the southern states. Mm-hmm. So when the states actually divided, is it any surprise that the northern states couldn't win because they hardly had anybody with both leadership as well as experience in the ranks throughout all of the ranks, if that makes sense? Because poverty, if you weren't a slave owner and a plantation, you know, owner, then you needed to find something to do. And if you didn't have slaves, then you didn't want to work, or you didn't mind working, you just maybe didn't want to make other people work for you. for whatever reason, the army seemed like a really good option for those people because they didn't have factories. They didn't have other types of businesses that were conducive for, you know, their interest, what have you. So for whatever reason, there was this large propensity of Southerners that found life, you know, fulfillment in service of the country, in the standing army. I believe, was it General Lee? I believe General Lee was not a plantation owner and he had no slaves. Robert E. Lee, I believe he was the general. I know that one of the key generals of the South didn't have slaves. Why were they in the army? Because they weren't a part of slavery. That's why you'll find that most of the officers, they didn't have plantations. They may have had a small little farm or what have you, may have had a few slaves, but they weren't like these big plantation owners. The people that were serving in the army were very small, and they were more of a family, you know, type of farm than these huge plantations, these franchises that I call them. So anyway, go ahead and read that little clause that you were going to do. This was direct taxation. I'm sorry.
The clause before you gives the power of direct taxation, unbounded and unlimited, exclusive power of legislation in all cases whatsoever for 10 miles square and over all places purchased for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, etc.
Right. And so if you kind of read through what he's making these assertions again, and it's, you know, in some cases, well, what's the problem with that? Who should be making the laws for the District of Columbia, for the police, and for the good order of the District of Columbia? Should the neighboring states inflict that upon them? And so he doesn't do – Patrick Henry is really good at, here's this problem. Look at this. This is exclusive. And then he gets picked apart easily by the Federalists. So anyway, so Governor Randolph is the next man that kind of stands up. And, you know, I think they run out of time quickly because it's a very short thing. So he comes back. And the first thing that we go into is paper money. And so let's dive into this short oration on paper money.
Page number, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. It is right after June 6th. I mean, it's page 42, just down a little bit.
I have before hinted at some other causes of quarrel between the other states and us, particularly the hatred that would be generated by commercial competitions. I will only add on that subject that controversies may arise concerning the fisheries, which may terminate in wars. Paper money may also be an additional source of disputes. Rhode Island has been in one continued train of opposition to national duties and integrity. They have defrauded their creditors by their paper money. Other states have also had emissions of paper money to the ruin of credit and commerce. May not Virginia at a future day also recur to the same expedient? Has Virginia no affection for paper money or disposition to violate contracts? I fear she is as fond of these measures as most other states in the Union. The inhabitants of the adjacent states would be affected by the depreciation of paper money, which would assuredly produce a dispute with those states. This danger is taken away by the present Constitution, as it provides that no state shall emit bills of credit.
So in other words, paper money, in other words, printing paper money. They can, I believe, no, they can't even coin. They have to use the national coins because Article 1, Section 10 forbids them from that. Now, down a little bit further in blue, there's this little note that is highlighted. So let's go ahead and read that.
Are we not taught by reason, experience, and governmental history that tyranny is a natural and certain consequence of uniting these two powers, or the legislative and judicial powers, exclusively in the same body? If anyone denies it, I shall pass by him as an infidel not to be reclaimed. Whenever any of these any two of these three powers are vested in one single body, they must, at one time or other, terminate in destruction of liberty. In the most important case, the assent of nine states is necessary to pass a law. That this is too great a restriction, and whatever good consequences it may, in some cases, produce, yet it will prevent energy in many other cases. It will prevent energy, which is most necessary on some emergencies, even in cases wherein the existence of the community depends on vigor and expedition.
Okay, so the importance of the separation of power highlighted, and then there's this other little note in the yellow with the green highlight there.
I'm afraid I have tired the patience of this house, but I trust you will pardon me, as I was urged by the importunity of the gentleman in calling for the reasons of laying the groundwork of this plan. It is objected by the honorable gentleman over the way, Mr. George Mason, that a Republican government is impracticable in an extensive territory, and the extent of the United States is urged as a reason for the rejection of this Constitution. Let us consider the definition of a Republican government as laid down by a man who is highly esteemed. Montesquieu, so celebrated among politicians, says that, quote, a Republican government is that in which the body, or only a part of the people, is possessed of the supreme power, a monarchical, that in which a single person governs by fixed and established laws, a despotic government, that in which a single person without law and without rule directs everything by his own will and caprice, end quote. The author has not distinguished a Republican government from a monarchy by the extent of its boundaries, but by the nature of its principles. He, in another place, contradistinguishes it as a government of laws in opposition to others which he denominates a government of men. The empire or government of laws, according to that phrase, is that in which the laws are made with the free will of the people. Hence, then, if laws be made by the assent of the people, the government may be deemed free. When laws are made with integrity and executed with wisdom, the question is whether a great extent of the country would tend to abridge the liberty of the people. If defensive force be necessary in proportion to the extent of country, I conceive that in a judiciously constructed government, be the country ever so extensive, its inhabitants will be proportionably numerous and able to defend it. Extent of my country, in my conception, ought to be no bar to the adoption of a good government. No extent on earth seems to be too great, provided the laws be wisely made and executed. The principles of representation and responsibility may pervade a large as well as small territory, and tyranny is as easily introduced into a small as into a large district. If it be answered that some of the most illustrious and distinguished authors are of a contrary opinion, I reply that authority has no weight with me till I am convinced that not the dignity of names, but the force of reasoning gains my assent.
Okay, so here's something that's kind of interesting, because Governor Randolph doesn't hint or understand, nor I believe any of the framers at this point in time, when they start talking about Montesquieu and a Republican form of government, they don't see the unfolding of a multi-tiered Republican republics. In other words, three layers, if not more, of republics. A national republic that has a very specific and limited responsibility of interfacing with foreign nations and providing security for all of the nations within it. Those nations being states. Now, those nations being states are a republic of countries. And in here, he uses that term country, because the country is where we find the community of likeness, the community of people that have like-minded, and they're all kind of agreeing why they're there. A state is a very large area of communities. When you look at Norfolk, and you look up north towards Richmond, or actually, if you look a little, I guess, northwest of Richmond, and you look up north to Fredericks, or these different places, Charlotte's, as we look throughout the state, we're going to find that these communities are like countries. Those communities were broken down into counties. Counties being the country that make up, or I should say, the counties are the republic of that state, where they're independent and, you know, I'll just call them independent and sovereign counties, or countries, where they have their own separate interest that they want to protect from those people who, you know, may have more people on the seaboard side, or less people, you know, in the multiple counties through the interior. Everybody has their interest. Everybody has and should be guarding their interest instead of being able to be ran over by whoever carries the big stick because they have the biggest population. So these men didn't fathom the what the Constitution basically gave us on a silver platter was a multi-tiered hybrid constitutional republic that allowed each of the states to reconform their constitutions to form a better republic. And what the county should have done was recognize that exact same thing, that they should have assumed, or the people should have granted and taken control of their county or their country and ensuring and guarding it against the other countries that they're competing with within that state, within that nation of countries. Now that you've boiled things down into these tiers, now we can even see today where most people would never even fathomed that you could take a county and break it into, you know, a republic as well. And when I say a republic, I'm talking about a major republic, such as the Republic of Los Angeles, the Republic of Manhattan or New York or Chicago or Atlanta and so forth and so on. And actually, if you look at Atlanta, folks, if you pulled up a map and hint, hint, nudge, nudge, if one pulled up a map of the counties of Georgia and then you looked at the area of Atlanta, the city of Atlanta and its area, one would find that Atlanta isn't sitting in a single county. Fulton County is a very small county, and we all know about Fulton County of Atlanta, where, you know, the shenanigans of the elections and so forth, and the charges against Trump and so forth. In other words, you know, a very dark blue little vestige in this red state that actually mounted this attack, you know, on the president and so forth. So when we look at Atlanta, I'm going to guess Atlanta may be somewhere between 12 and 20 counties.
Georgia has 159 counties.
Yeah, okay, that's a lot for a small state.
Okay.
Yeah.
The metropolitan area of Atlanta includes 29 counties.
Wow. Okay, so folks, if you didn't hear that, it's 29 counties. When we come back, because obviously the show's over, we will pick this back up in talking about this hybrid constitution republic. You know, and how when we look at Atlanta, it's a perfect model of Atlanta becoming its own republic. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.